We're talking girl power and politics on the 21st today. Here's Fox's Megyn Kelly in exchange with Newt Gingrich this week.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not fascinated by sex, but I am fascinated by the protection of women and understanding what we're getting in the Oval Office.
How women are being talked about, treated, and perceived this campaign season. Also, this is the first year that girl superhero costumes are outselling princess ones, that and other popular Halloween outfits.
I want to be a masquerade.
I'm looking to be an army person or maybe a fruit.
You know, if I could find a Yoshi onesie, that's kind of my number one, but who knows?
And finally, Sherry Runner, CEO of the Chicago Urban League, joins us to discuss the barriers that African Americans continue to face in Chicago and a blueprint the organization recently released to help create more equity. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've got lots going on today. Later, we're going to be speaking with the Chicago Urban League CEO, Sherry Runner, about the civic organization's ambitious plan for creating a more equitable Chicago. And do you have your Halloween costume ready? Clowns, presidential candidates, and a whole category of girl power costumes are big this year. Speaking of girl power, this year's presidential election has taken the country in many directions. And one of the biggest themes to emerge has been how women are being perceived and treated, whether that's Hillary Clinton as the first female presidential candidate or the women who have accused both Donald Trump and President Bill Clinton of sexual assault. As if this election season needed any more polarizing moments, on Monday evenings, here's Fox News' The Kelly Files with Megyn Kelly's guest, former House Speaker and Trump advisor Newt Gingrich. Megyn and House Speaker Gingrich were talking about polling, which led to a conversation about Donald Trump and the accusations women have made against him.
As a media story, we don't get to say the 10 women are lying. Oh. We have to cover that story, sir.
Sure. Okay, so it's worth—
Then Newt Gingrich went on to complain about the lack of media coverage surrounding Hillary Clinton's controversies, and he made this comment, which has hit headlines all over.
You are fascinated with sex, and you don't care about public policy.
Me?
Now, that's
really
what I get out of watching you tonight.
You know what? Mr. Speaker, I'm not fascinated by sex, but I am fascinated by the protection of women and understanding what we're getting in the Oval Office. And I think the American voters would like
and
to know.
And therefore, we're going to send Bill Clinton back to the East Wing because, after all, you are worried about sexual predators.
Yeah, listen, it's not about me. It's about the women and men of America. And the poll numbers show us that the women of America in particular are very concerned about these allegations and in large part believe that they are a real issue. And
do you want to comment on whether the Clinton ticket has a relationship to a sexual predator?
We on the Kelly File have covered that story as well, sir. I will tell you the
polls. I want to hear your words. Bill Clinton, sexual predator. I dare you. Say Bill Clinton, sexual predator.
Mr. Speaker,
disbarred by the Arkansas bar. Disbarred by the Arkansas bar. $850,000 penalty.
Excuse me, sir. We on the Kelly File have covered the Clinton matter as well. We've hosted Kathleen Willey. We've covered the examples of him being accused as well, but he's not on the ticket. And the polls also show that
the
American public is less interested in the deeds of Hillary Clinton's husband than they are in the deeds of the man who asks us to make him president, Donald Trump. We're going to have to leave it at that, and you can take your anger issues and spend some time working on them, Mr. Speaker. Thanks for being
here. And you too.
Oh, boy. What do you think about this conversation we've been having all year in the past few months about women, how they're being perceived, discussed, what it means for future female politicians? You can tweet us. We've been having a conversation with some of you all morning on Twitter. Keep that going. Our handle is 21STShow. That's 21st show. Joining us now to talk about all of this is Rebecca Sive. She's the originator of the hashtag Girl Politics, the author of Every Day is Election Day, A Women's Guide to Winning Any Office. She's also at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. Rebecca, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Nyla. It's a pleasure.
Rebecca, I wonder what your reaction is to everything that you've heard so far with, let's start with your reaction to this Monday evening tape.
Well, first of all, to coin a phrase from my nieces, it's laugh out loud to watch these petulant men, and Monday night it was Newt Gingrich, but it's really not funny. They are failing to recognize the fact that the Republican candidate for president, talked about sexual assault as something he engaged in. And the fact is, one of your tweeters noted this morning, I was glad to see it, that should be an automatic disqualifier for the highest office in the land, but apparently it's not. So this is just a horrible situation, really.
And I wonder, I mean, if we think about women and we think about, remember this being bipartisan, of women who have accused both Donald Trump and Bill Clinton of these issues, those women, is there anything different in the way those women are being treated now?
Well, I think there's two important things that are going on. One is the candidate on the other side is Hillary Clinton, not Bill Clinton, and what we ought to be talking about is the issues. I think the second thing here is that the proof is in the polls, and what they show is that women of from all over the country and in various, you know, economic and racial and ethnic backgrounds are moving over to Hillary Clinton, including, most interestingly, I thought in the last couple of days, movement among women evangelical voters. So clearly they're looking at these two candidates and they're saying, I don't trust that guy. I think he's dangerous, on top of which he doesn't seem to know a whole lot about things that concern us, for instance, health care, as was clear the other night in the speech he gave. So I think the primary focus here is women's remarkable, not surprising, ability to assess the two candidates and decide what's better for them.
Rebecca, it sounds like we're having a tough time with your line. I'm going to actually, if you can just hold on a second, I'm going to see if we can get a hold of you and call you back, because we're having a hard time hearing you. But we're talking this morning about women in politics, how women are being perceived, how women are being discussed. And we've, as I mentioned, we've been talking to folks on Twitter. If you want to tweet to us, it's 21st Show, 21ST Show. We had a comment earlier from Meg, as Rebecca was mentioning. She said, not only are the... She said, are you satisfied with this conversation? And Meg said, not only is she not satisfied with this conversation, how can she be? Sexual assault is a crime. Bragging about it should make you disqualified. And the double standards surrounding Hillary Clinton are obvious and ridiculous. Apart from, I wonder if we can, I don't know, Rebecca, if it's possible to even take out sort of the partisan nature of this, because I think the way that people are, I think the way that people are approaching this on either side is such a polarizing thing. But I wonder if there is a way to separate the politics from it and just talk about the way that women are being perceived. Are you seeing any changes?
Well, I think that in terms of perception, what the comments of the candidates have been, apart from the partisan nature of this circumstance, what women are seeing is the vastly different views of Mr. Trump and Secretary Clinton on issues of importance to women. So regardless of party, regardless of a particular campaign, you know, it's been proven that women care about economic security and child care and education and access to health care. And so they've been able, which is a good thing in this campaign, to see two really different perspectives and to evaluate those. So I think that's a positive of what's come about in this particular presidential campaign.
And Rebecca, I wonder, I mean, we have such a big race going on here for the U.S. Senate with Representative Tammy Duckworth facing Senator Mark Kirk. And I wonder, do you think that Tammy Duckworth has faced similar issues? Oh, it looks like, I'm sorry, it looks like we've had some problems with Rebecca. Let's try to get her back on the line. Again, we're talking about women in politics. We're talking about women and how they've been perceived during this election season. If you want to join our conversation, our number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. You can post a comment on our Facebook page as well, where we like to have people doing comments. Let's see if we can get Rebecca back on the line. Sorry about those technical difficulties. Rebecca, you back?
I am.
Okay, there we go. So what I was asking you about was, we have such a huge race going on here with the U.S. Senate, with Representative Tammy Duckworth and facing Senator Mark Kirk. Do you think Tammy Duckworth has faced similar issues in this campaign?
Well, I think that, you know, she can speak best for herself, but I think that what women candidates in general face is a higher bar to being considered seriously and to having their policy positions listened to and to being, you know, sufficiently considered to be qualified for positions in which men, you know, have normally been. So I think that while Duckworth has done well in this campaign, and she appears to be ahead, my guess is she would tell you that she's experienced certain circumstances in which she thought she was treated unequally. That's certainly the experience that most candidates have, if not every day from time to time.
And do you think there's a difference between the way Republican politicians, female politicians are treated versus Democrats? And I'm thinking about, I'm also thinking about what happens. I'm thinking about the way that women politicians work together. And what I'm just remembering is a conversation I had with State Senator Toy Hutchinson about Judy Bartopinka, you know, one of our most iconic female politicians in the state, a Republican, and her sharing a story of how when she got to Springfield, how Judy Bartopinka reached out to her and said, hey, we're, this is how I'm going to mentor you. Do you think that on a state level, do you think that happens more often, I wonder?
Well, historically, it has happened in Illinois, where the women in the state legislature got together and worked in a bipartisan fashion on issues. I've had this conversation with Representative Schakowsky and others who served in the legislature. It's also true that given the increasing divide in the philosophies of the two parties, it's happening less frequently on an issue level. But I think you're right that it's happening on a regular basis on a person-to-person level. I think the other thing for Republican women is it's harder for them to get in the first place. So because they tend to be more liberal than their male counterparts. So there's kind of an unequal situation for them right now, which, you know, is distressing. And I think that what we've seen in the last few days is that Republican women are really having a problem identifying with the party period, whether they're choosing to run or not, because of the derogatory comments Mr. Trump has made, which is frankly a shame. We ought to have women across the board.
Well, Rebecca, how much do you think all of this is detracting from conversations about issues that are important to women? And I'm thinking in particular of the issue of equal pay, which is actually should be an issue that's important to men and women, right? The Economic Policy Institute yesterday put out a report that's a compilation of research on the gender pay gap. We'll tweet out that entire report for people who are interested. But in 2015, the typical woman was paid 83 cents for every dollar earned by her male counterparts on an hourly basis. What other policy conversations aren't we having right now?
Well, a couple that came to mind as I was thinking about this conversation, Nyla, was one about childcare and two about healthcare. You know, for instance, in the Clinton platform, there is a series of, I think, very significant recommendations on how to deal with the cost of childcare, which, you know, affects millions and millions of American women. So I'm not sure how much attention that's gotten, and I think that's a shame. I think the second example is in the context of healthcare, where the discussion, at least in the last few days, has been solely about the cost of premiums rising, which of course is a problem. But at the same time, there are incredibly important benefits in that law for women and children. And, you know, there, I haven't seen a serious policy conversation about weighing the good and the bad. That's the kind of thing I think that would be very helpful, as you're saying, to both male and female voters. What's best for my family, right? Should my wife be making the same pay as I'm making for the same job? I bet most men would say yes.
You started the hashtag girl politics. What do you want those discussions to be about?
Well, just what we're talking about, you know, first of all, the opportunity for women to participate in politics and policymaking. And second of all, to talk about the issues that women care about and want to see our governments and our politicians address. And I think thirdly, to just sort of really, really encourage women and girls. And on that note, I just want to tell you that yesterday or the day before, I got this wonderful email from a group of students in another state, young women in high school. They want to run for office. They apparently bought my book to use in their book club. I mean, it's that kind of thing that, you know, whether or not they decide to run, but if they get engaged, that's really, you know, kind of the goal.
Rebecca, we just have about a minute or two left, but I do wonder about that younger generation and what the engagement mm-hmm. we see with young women, whether they're younger women or millennials. Do you feel like mm-hmm. that age range is still so activated and engaged, even despite everything we've seen over the past couple of months?
Well, apparently millennial women in terms of the presidential are moving toward Hillary Clinton, and they were sort of not for a while. So I think among young women voters, they are paying attention, which of course is typical for late in the campaign. And I imagine that they're having more conversations with their friends just because of some of the issues that, you know, we've discussed and are at stake. So I'm confident, you know, just like any generation, you sort of have to wake up, get engaged, figure out what you can do. And once you've done that, go for it.
And that said, the next conversation we're going to have is about Halloween costumes. And we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to tell you, this year, kids are buying, young girls are buying more superhero costumes than princess costumes.
Oh,
and it's the first time ever.
Cool.
So I wonder how you think that relates to young women and girls today.
Well, I kind of think it's that expression which I've heard a lot, which is you can't be what you can't see. And among other things, these girls are seeing more women superheroes and heroic figures in our popular culture. So I think it's fabulous that they want to express that in their own lives. And I just hope there's more and more of it, because they can be. You just have to decide, and they don't even need a costume.
You can check out the hashtag Girl Politics for the conversation originated by Rebecca Saive. She's the author of Every Day is Election Day, A Woman's Guide to Winning Any Office from the PTA to the White House. Rebecca, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Nyla.
On the 21st, we'll be talking about this year's most popular Halloween costumes. We visited a shop to find out what you're buying. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
I want to be a masquerade. It's like a person that has a big, like, ball gown dress and is in a mask. I don't know.
I wanted to be a gypsy tarot reader because I actually read tarot cards, but I couldn't find one. Normally, I go as Trinity from Matrix.
I don't know what I'm looking for. I'm looking for inspiration.
Anything jumped out at you so far?
The pineapple. Not sure why, but I like the pineapple.
And I'm kind of just, like, looking for, like, something that's, like, fun and, like, maybe a little bit funny. Right now I'm trying to do a maid.
I'm going
to
be a hippie and a cowgirl.
I'm looking to be an army person or maybe a fruit. I don't know, something funny.
Did you find your costume yet, or are you still looking?
I was trying to look.
You got your costume.
Where is it?
It's at home.
It's at home.
You know, if I could find a Yoshi onesie, that's kind of my number one, but who knows?
Thanks to producer Christine Herman for talking to those shoppers at Dallas & Company in downtown Champaign yesterday afternoon. As you heard, lots of options for costumes this year. Dallas & Company actually ran out of Clinton and Trump masks. That's because with the 2016 presidential election on top of people's minds, costumes about our presidential candidates are among the most popular this year. Americans plan to spend more than $8 billion on Halloween. We're at an all-time high for how much we spend on costumes as well, $31 a pop. We're joined on the phone now by Anna Smith. She's the director of media relations with the National Retail Federation. They've done studies on Halloween costume buying for more than a decade. Anna, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, I'm happy to be on the line with you guys today.
You're on the line from Washington. I should say every election year, there's a spike in the number of people dressing up as politicians for Halloween. What did your survey show for this year? No different, I imagine.
Definitely nothing different. You know, in the 2008 election, we saw that almost a million adults wanted to dress up as a political character. Then that number actually increased right now for the 2012 season, it being a very controversial political season. We're seeing that adults at ages 35 and older, they want to dress up as either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump for Halloween. But that came in third place after pirates and witches.
Oh, okay. So pirates, witches, then presidential candidates. And yesterday we actually asked Josh Hansen, he's the marketing director at Dallas & Company, about presidential costumes. Here's what he had to say about it.
It's been kind of fun to keep up with the demand with it because we didn't think, like, people would receive them so well. Both of them are pretty, like, colorful in terms of, like, their characters. Like, people put on the mask and it's like, hey, look at me, I'm Donald Trump, you know, and people just love taking pictures and selfies with them. They just put them on and just laugh and kind of just poke fun at it all.
That's Josh Hansen, marketing manager at Dallas & Company in Champaign. Anna, why is this such a go-to costume for many adults? And I wonder, like, as he's talking about the selfies, how much social media is playing a role in the costumes that we're picking this year?
You know, one of the things that we learned in our survey is that online and social media are some of the top places where consumers are going to be searching for inspiration for their costumes, but as well as what's happening just in everyday cultural trends. So not that coming as a surprise of the whole Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton costumes. We're seeing it very much being picked up on Pinterest and Instagram, et cetera. Folks, like he mentioned, taking selfies with them, kind of poking fun of it and sharing it already, or they're already giving a preview of what their costume is going to be like for this weekend for Halloween. And it's a trend that we've heard from many retailers. They're either selling out or these particular outfits are just moving very, very fast. And again, you know, these characters aren't the only ones that are pretty popular right now that are selling off the shelves, but it's the ones that are getting the most attraction.
Well, to that point about people wanting to take selfies, I wonder, your survey has found that spending on Halloween costumes has consistently gone up. And I wonder, more people started spending on costumes you found from like 2010. I mean, do you think how much of this has to do with people taking pictures and people wanting to have photographs and things like that as evidence, or maybe wanting to look better than their friends? Like, it's kind of a competition for social media who looks the best. Do you think that might be part of why people are spending more on costumes? Or adults
it
are, I guess?
It definitely is. Okay. It's, you know, it really, yes, that's the answer. When we really dig into our data, we're seeing that there's a particular age group that is pushing forward this high spend, high celebration for Halloween, and that's millennials. Again, it comes to no surprise because they are the ones that love social media, love promoting everything that they're doing, kind of showing off at the same time. And so Halloween gives them that experience where you can be something that you want to be that you can't be any other time of the year, and show off to all your friends and do fun things that normally, again, you won't be able to do any other time of the year, like host a Halloween costume party or host a even Halloween pet costume parties. I've seen some of those already trending.
Did you say Halloween pet costume party?
Oh yeah, people love dressing up their pets, and they're hosting parties just to show off who has the best pet costume.
So are those mostly for dogs? Can you have costumes for other pets?
Oh, you can have costumes for cats. And the hilarious part is I've seen cats dressed up as bumblebees and hot dogs and even as lions. It's really funny.
I can't imagine a cat. I feel like cats wouldn't tolerate that as well as dogs.
Well, actually, dogs don't tolerate it that well either.
That's
it's
a good
more
point.
More for humans than for the actual pets itself.
What are the top costumes for millennials? Because we talked about political costumes very big with people who are over 35. What about millennials? What are the big costumes for that age range?
One of the things that we're noticing with millennials is that they love do-it-yourself costumes or adding a lot of do-it-yourself elements to their costumes. So the top three costumes this year are Batman characters, witches, and animals. Again, in all three of those, there's a lot of elements where they can just go into their closet, pull some stuff out, and maybe write something on their shirt and call it a day, or even just go to a discount store or a Halloween costume store just to add a couple of those items that are missing on their costume to complement it. So it's a trend that we're going to see keep on growing with millennials. Those three particular costumes continue on being pretty strong with them, though, year over year.
Another hot topic we had this year were clown costumes, largely due to the creepy, which I've been surprised by this, because I would think the creepy clown craze happening around the country would make people not want to be clowns. I don't know if they're trying to reclaim that back. We talked to Josh about this as well from Dallas & Company in Champaign, and here's what he had to say.
Clowns have always been like a Halloween staple. But I don't necessarily think like it's been as popular in past years as it has been this year, because this year, like with the recent like viral thing going around with like clown sightings, those are definitely like we've seen an increase of sales with those.
Now, Anna, I wanted to ask you about that because he said they've seen an increase at his store. I know some retailers like Target have said they're not selling clown masks. Have you seen how, I wonder if lots of major retailers are also saying, hey, this is kind of a weird, bad thing that's happening. We don't want to try to encourage that, so we're not going to be selling it.
It's really unfortunate that this is happening right now during a time of year where a lot of people truly enjoy. And definitely on our end, one of the things that we've seen and heard from our retailers is that they are reacting on a preventative scale. So if there's an opportunity to kind of stop this trend, obviously the negative side of it, they're going to do so. And this is as well as something that we've learned that retailers just tend to do overall. If there's something that, you know, it's for the community, for the benefit of the community, it's best to remove off their shelves, they will do so. So this is definitely one of those unfortunate moments. But looking on the other end of it, in regards to consumers wanting to dress up as clowns in general, like we heard, it is one of those costumes that is just kind of traditional to see during the Halloween season. When we're looking into our data this year, it's actually not one of the top trending costumes this year, but if we dig a little bit deeper into adults 35 and older, they are considering to wear a scary costume or mask. So that can maybe potentially be a scary clown costume, but it you know, right there, we're looking more into the weaves. But mm-hmm. still, that's still falling into ninth place out of all the top costumes that we're seeing trending right now.
Anna, I wanted to switch over to a different demographic and talk about young people and children, because who were traditionally the only people who used to wear Halloween costumes. But since the National Retail Federation has been doing the survey, the number one costume for girls has always been a princess. This year, that wasn't the case. What did you guys see?
So this year, Princess actually got dethroned, and that's the best way to put it, and they're in second place. The first place this year, we're seeing a lot more action superhero costumes for children, or at least that's what they're telling us that they want to dress up this year. And that, again, is very much because of what we've seen in movie theaters this year, as well as comics. There's been a lot more superhero type of movies that came out this year that are influencing boys and girls to dress up as those characters. So with Star Wars and Supergirl, the television series, and Wonder Woman, and some other items like that, it's providing girls with plenty of action hero inspirations, as well as for little boys.
Mm-hmm. And I know we spoke earlier this morning with a representative from Spirit Halloween. That's the largest retail specialty store in the country. And they have a whole category. They have number two. They have a whole category called Girl Power. So that ranges from everything from superheroes, like you mentioned, like Wonder Woman, to everyday costumes like firefighters and police officers and doctors. Did you find there are other costumes that young women said they wanted to do that sort of played into dethroning princesses from the number one spot?
So we actually, when we look at our children's costume data, we don't break down by gender, but we believe that the reason why action and superheroes got bumped up from princess is because it's allowing now more girls. There are a lot more female superheroes out there, so it's allowing girls to want to be one of those for the season. But if we look at some of the other characters that children would want to be for Halloween, you know, some of them could actually be unisex, so animals are pretty much unisex. You could some other characters, like the Frozen characters, are mostly targeted to girls, but some Marvel superheroes are mostly for boys. So that's how we could kind of gauge which one is leaning towards more boys or versus girls.
Mm-hmm. And do you know, I don't know how much you guys have done survey research on with children, whether they're boys or girls. In general, do you know how much parents control what kids want with costumes? Or is it kids who just say, like, I want to do this? I don't know if you guys have ever surveyed research on that.
We have, in general, for all of our research, we ask our consumers who is the one that's basically taking charge in regards to how they're spending in these stores. And it's definitely children are the ones that are telling their parents, this is what I want to be. Obviously, if you're an infant, that's very difficult, and it's going to be
sure. It's always right
on that one. Yeah. But children who can speak their mind and say what they want to be for Halloween, they're going to tell their parents to do so. And that's definitely something that we're seeing trending in all of our consumer surveys.
And I wanted to ask you, your survey found that people are expected to spend $8.4 billion on Halloween this year. How does this compare to previous years?
This is actually the highest that we've seen in our survey history. And again, this is definitely thanks to millennials. They love Halloween. It's also a moment in time where it could be very nostalgic for some of them. You know, you're going back to trick-or-treating, which is something that's very it's very traditional for Halloween, but yet you can do a lot of new things that, thanks to technology, that in the past folks weren't really exploring. So like the whole pet costume party thing.
Well, how much do you think, is this a reflection of the economy? Do we find that people spend, is this a sign that the economy is doing well, that people are spending more this year? Or what does that show? How does spending sort of track with the general economy over the past couple of years?
If we're looking at the economy, definitely. You know, over the last couple of months, even, we are in a lot stronger position. A lot more consumers are currently working or are part of the workforce. Wages also have gone up slightly. So that has encouraged for a lot of consumers to spend more when traditionally they have saved more. Not saying that they're not saving, but they're splurging a little bit more on moments in time where they really wouldn't, like Halloween, for instance. They're deciding that they're going to spend a little bit more on costumes and a little bit more on candy and decorations and what they have in the past because they have that extra money to do so.
One last quick question for you, Anna. Where does Halloween spending come in the category of all the other holidays? How much more do Americans spend on Halloween versus, say, Easter or Christmas?
When we're looking at all of our consumer spending surveys, Halloween actually falls in eighth place. It's between 4th of July and Father's Day. So Father's Day actually still gets a little bit more spending than Halloween.
Okay.
Yeah. But the number one spending season of the year, as everyone knows, are the winter holidays.
Sure. That's Anna Smith. She's Senior Director of Media Relations with the National Retail Federation in Washington, D.C. Anna, thanks for taking time to be with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight. For my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
You can follow us on Twitter, by the way. Search for 21st Show. That's 21ST Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on the air, you can find top news and stories about Illinois if you follow us. On our Facebook page, if you search for the 21st to like us, you can comment on what we're working on. You can post questions or comments you want us to ask on the air. By the way, we've been talking about issues that matter to Illinois voters during the presidential campaign. The day before the election, on November 7th, we're going to do a special hour of fact-checking. Do you have something you're not clear about, whether it's a claim that's made by an Illinois or a national politician? Tweet us your questions to 21st Show. You can email us, talk@21stshow.org. You can leave us a voicemail. The phone number is 217-300-2121. All of these ways to contact us are on our website, www.21stshow.org. So that's actually the only thing you need to remember. Go to 21stshow.org if you want to get in touch with us. Let us know if you have a claim you want fact-checked, and we'll talk about it the day before the election. Stay tuned. Coming up, we're going to be talking to the CEO of the Chicago Urban League, Sherry Runner. You're listening to the 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's not good enough to simply agree that racism is a barrier for African Americans in the United States, so writes the CEO of the Chicago Urban League in a blueprint it introduced recently to help create a more equitable Chicago. This blueprint has clear goals: improve unemployment rates, increase high school graduation rates and homeownership rates among the African American community over the next 10 years, which would take us to the 110th anniversary of the Urban League, which celebrates its centennial this year. The CEO of the Chicago Urban League, Sherry Runner, joins us now. Sherry, welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
I know this is, as we mentioned, your 100th anniversary, and you all have had special events going on all year to commemorate this. And one of these is the blueprint that you all released. You wrote that you were tired of hearing the same narratives. You're tired of people denying that race was an issue. Can you tell me a little bit more about what led to you writing that introduction to this plan?
Yeah, I think the most important thing that we have to face is that, especially in the environment that we're in right now, where there's a lot of unrest and distrust and overall dissatisfaction in the community, that things have not changed as much as we thought they had. And when the president was elected in 2008, there was this whole desire to make everyone believe that we were now post-racial. Well, clearly that's not true. It has not been true throughout his presidency, and the kind of treatment that he's gotten generally in the public and the kind of things that are going on within the African-American community that really come from, that are caused by policies and practices that have occurred over the last 50 or 60 years that have put African-American people in a situation, especially in Chicago, that allows racist practices to continue and to devalue the community.
When you think about racist practices in particular, you all have three kind of main areas that you focus on in this report. You look at education, you look at employment, and you look at economic opportunity. And I wanted to ask you, when you think about those things, you say that you want to shift the narrative. How do you shift the narrative around the people who think of poverty and violence? And to your mind, you see that as a symptom of racism. Can you explain a little bit more of what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think the thing to start with is what is really being focused on, especially in Chicago right now, is the violence in our communities, where we know that there are shootings every weekend, every day of every week, actually, and most of that violence is being confined to some of the highest poverty neighborhoods in the city of Chicago. Those neighborhoods just happen to be communities of color where resources have been decimated over a period of time. So there's high unemployment rate. There is a very strong underground economy, which puts people at risk. There is a flood of guns and drugs, the drug trades in those communities. And that violence comes as a part of that. So when you think about that, and over time, what that poverty has done to families, these communities were not always like that. They were supported by industrial businesses, and people were graduating from high schools and able to go to jobs that were available in the city of Chicago. And as those industries moved out of those communities, people became unemployed and had to do what they needed to do in order to support their families. Doesn't mean that that's, you know, the right way for things to be done. Obviously, everybody would prefer that that's not the only resource or the only recourse that people have. It's really important to know that, though, with jobs, with an improved educational system that really focused on the kinds of industries and jobs that are available in Chicago today, a lot of this violence could be mitigated.
Let's talk about a specific of your plan. You talk about improving African-American high school graduation rates by 15% over the next 10 years. And, you know, there's a lot of benefits to improving the high school graduation rate. In fact, you point out in your report that if we were to keep the at-risk group on track for graduation in Illinois, we would increase their individual lifetime earnings by $376 million, their consumer spending by $279 million, and Illinois' annual tax base by $35 million. What needs to be done? Let's start with high school graduation. You all identify obstacles and then how to overcome those. To your mind, how can we improve high school graduation rates among African-American young people in the city of Chicago?
Well, I think that, you know, that's a really multifaceted question, but I think everybody knows that the Chicago Urban League has been fighting with the State Board of Education for the past 9 years over equitable funding. The real important thing is, how do you get kids in places where we know kids who live in poverty need more resources, and they need to get them into those schools so that we can start to see our graduation rates increase.
Right, because it doesn't just start at high school, right? So when we look at a stat that says half of African-American youth who attend a predominantly African-American CPS schools don't graduate, I mean, there's a lot behind those numbers, right? So, for example, with this problem, where would you start identifying partners and other resources to help? Because the funding is just part of the problem.
Right. The funding is part of the problem. But, it leads to so many things, and it starts there, because with additional resources, as you start to see how many different things are impacted by what schools can do when they have a budget that fully funds their operations, then you get better outcomes, you get better results. So it is not just high schools, it is grade schools. We have heard a lot of discussion lately about the fact that kids are lost by the time that they're in third grade because of their ability to read and their ability to succeed. We even know that it starts as early as early childhood. So youngsters who are talked to and what needs to be done in order to help support the community in a way that parents and schools work together to make that happen.
I'm speaking with Sherry Runner. She's the CEO of the Chicago Urban League. We're talking about their blueprint for creating a more equitable Chicago that they've had out now, and discussing their 10-year plan they have to try to improve different parts of Chicago, make it, as they say, more equitable. Sherry, how did you all identify? You mentioned the 19 of 77 communities in Chicago you all wanted to focus on. How did you identify and pick those neighborhoods?
Well, those communities are primarily African Americans. There are more than 40% of the residents there are living underneath the poverty line, and the jobless rates, it coincides with where we're seeing the biggest problems in the city of Chicago. Joblessness, violence, those are those communities.
Let's talk about another issue that you brought up at the beginning, which is employment. And when we look at the unemployment rate, when we think about, for example, the percentage of unemployed African Americans of working age. So if we think about ages 16 to 64 in Chicago, it's basically double the unemployment rate it is for their white counterparts. So we're looking at maybe 30% unemployment rate by some of measures. And there's another reports we've seen, and I think people are always shocked when we say this, that they're somewhere in the range of 90% of African American youth aged 16 to 24 that are unemployed. How, and we've heard Mayor Emanuel being talk about this, especially in the past couple of weeks. Jobs is always something that people talk about when they talk about alleviating poverty and crime. How do you all propose to look at this issue in a way that's different from others?
I think the thing is that on top of the statistics that you just stated, one of the things that's important to know is that there are a number of jobs that are going unfilled in the city of Chicago right now. I've heard, tens of thousands of jobs because people don't have the requisite skills to access those jobs. So one of the things that we really feel is important is to make sure that those youth that are disengaged, so those 16 to 24-year-olds who are out of school and out of work and not working, get those skills, start to get trained. And that's going to take a real public-private partnership, because what needs to be done is for corporate citizens to take a different kind of look at what it will mean to have an entry-level employee and what kind of investment will they have to make in that entry-level employee to get him up to speed, him or her up to speed, to do the jobs that are there. And that's going to take a real change of attitude, heads, hearts, minds about what's the importance, how important is that to make sure that our city and these communities start to thrive, because with jobs and with the kinds of jobs that turn into careers, people start to think differently about what is their trajectory, their chance for a better life, and what they can and will expect for their communities.
Sherry, how do you get corporations to think differently, especially when we're talking about Chicago, right? Because, I think a large part of this also is, as you mentioned, industries have left. I imagine you want to work with companies that see themselves as civic partners within the city. And do you feel that there's a level of corporate and civic engagement within Chicago now to be able to make this kind of commitment and cultural change that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think this is the thing. And we hear every day about the number of corporations that are relocating to Chicago.
Sure.
A lot of them are coming to the downtown area. They're not necessarily being incentivized to take their businesses to some of these communities where the jobless rates are really high and where they may have a huge impact on the trajectory of Chicago. We know that if you allow these kinds of areas to decay to the point where they die off, that that's not good for Chicago. It's not good for our tax base. It's not good for our population. It's not good for just being a diverse city that has the African-American community has been such a huge contributor to over the past 100 years. So I think as corporations think about what their role is, that these people who live in these neighborhoods are not only consumers, they're customers, but they're also their potential pipeline for the workforce. And that's those are two critical components of what corporations think about when they're thinking about why should I be in Chicago or what makes Chicago an attractive place to live.
What kind of partners have you all already identified that you feel like you need to work closely with to achieve all of these things we've been talking about?
Well, there have been, it's a very wide range. It's actually very interesting since we've published the report, the kinds of outreach that has come from people being interested in really discussing this. This is a hard issue. We know that race is always hard to discuss. So people are coming out and saying, yeah, we've got to do something about it. This is, it's a crucial, it's a watershed time, and we cannot continue to do what we have been doing to make the city a better place. So the people, we've talked to people anywhere from the Sierra Club and Brookfield Zoo who are interested in partnering with us. We've talked with several community-based organizations because we know that there's so much good work going on out there already in various neighborhoods. And we kind of need to come together and as a coalition and start thinking about what are the real needs and where are the resources to get this work done. So, and of course, we've talked to some of our governmental parties partners as well. What can they do? How can they be involved in making this change?
And so when I just wanted to ask you about, so the response that you're getting, do you feel like, are there people you would like to hear from that you haven't heard from yet?
We'd like to partner with any and everyone who feels that this is an important part of what makes Chicago a great place to live. So, we haven't heard from everybody in the world, but we have heard from quite a few people. So we're very, very pleased with the response and know that there are a lot more out there. And as we become more strategic about exactly what are the areas that we've discovered where there are real holes and resources, we will identify those people and reach out as well. We're not waiting for people to come to us. We absolutely want to make sure that we go out into the community as well.
Before I let you go, your 100th anniversary gala is coming up soon in a few weeks. Diana Ross is going to be performing and you're honoring Spencer Leake Sr. What do you want people to be talking about at the gala? I don't know if this blueprint will actually be part of the conversation, but just wanted to ask you about that.
Well, we always have a time during the gala to commemorate, think about what's happened in the past year. Both locally and nationally, and talk about some of the most important issues that we see facing the African American community. So, in some ways, the purpose of the 10-year plan, the blueprint, will be discussed. I don't think we'll hand it out at the dinner, but we absolutely want to take a look at and have, this is a celebration for us in terms of what we have accomplished during the year. But we also want to be very grounded in what still needs to be done and where we're going to do that and how we're going to be a part of that solution.
Sherry Runner is the CEO of the Chicago Urban League. Sherry, thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, we're going to continue our Halloween theme, talking about Illinois' most haunted places. We're going to speak with one lucky Chicago dad who scored tickets for him and his son to attend the Cubs' first home game of the World Series, which is tomorrow night. Go Cubs! We've been talking about issues that matter to Illinois voters during the presidential campaign. The day before the election on November 7th, we're doing a special hour of fact-checking. If you have something you're not clear about before you vote, whether it's a claim made by an Illinois or a national politician, you can tweet your questions to us. You can email us. It's talk@21stshow. You can leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. All of these ways to contact us are on our website, www.21stshow.org. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app if you search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. We're produced by Howla Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.